It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheim. The earthquake that devastated the country of Nepal over the weekend has resulted in a death toll of over 4,000. Pittsburgh is home to approximately 4,000 ethnically Nepalese-Bhutanese refugees. Joining us by phone with a look at how members of the local Nepalese-Bhutanese community are reaching out to their homeland is Bibhuti Arial, president and co-founder of Rukmini Foundation. Bibhuti Arial, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure this is a difficult time for Pittsburgh's Nepalese Bhutanese community. Where did you and when did you first learn of the earthquake?
I learned of the earthquake when I woke up on Saturday morning. Obviously, it happened at our nighttime. So as soon as I got up, my wife told me because she had already woken up and read an article about it. So I learned it from her.
Have you been able to communicate with family members still in Nepal?
Not directly, not on the telephone yet, but indirectly through extended family and then through social media. I have been informed that most of my immediate family and friends appear to be okay. And within the last day, some communication lines have started to open up. So I've been seeing a little bit more activity online from extended family. So not directly, but, I'll take what I can get at this point.
Who do you know that lives there still? What members of your family?
Sure. I have a fairly big extended family. And growing up, I lived in a house with three different families under one roof. So my cousin, my grandfather, and many uncles and aunts are still living in Nepal.
The Nepalese-Bhutanese community is one of the largest immigrant communities in Pittsburgh. How has it come together to respond to this tragedy?
So, there are, I think, two separate communities, but as you mentioned, ethnically the same background. There's a Nepali community, and there's also the Bhutanese-Nepali community as well. And what we've done is we've tried to gather leaders from both communities to come together as one. And we just recently held a meeting at the SC Temple in Penn Hills. That was when we first got a chance to gather our people to help people kind of reconcile with what happened. And we're also holding a vigil at Market Square between 12 to 1. So we're trying to do these things, one, to help our community here feel like they're not alone, but also to raise awareness about the scale of the disaster and then the difficulty that lies ahead for our country.
And what are you doing to send aid to Nepal?
What we've tried to do is, immediately after the earthquake, people wanted to know, okay, what can I do? And people were working off emotion and trying to start their own thing. So one of the first few things we did as a community was to say, let's find organizations that have the capacity to actually deliver aid. In these kinds of situations, not everybody can really provide disaster relief. So we've identified a few organizations that have, one, great reputation, but two, have a good track record of being able to deliver aid in times like this. So we created a social media Facebook page to help people that may want to know where to donate. So we provided a few links for them through that page. And that's I think that's really helped to funnel aid to effective organizations and also helping people that may not know how they can provide help.
We're talking with Bibhuti Arial, president and co-founder of Rukmini Foundation on Essential Pittsburgh here on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. For people who've never been or know very little about Nepal, what would you like to share with us about the country and its people?
I think a lot of people know Nepal through some famous symbols like Mount Everest, being the tallest mountain in the world. People that know Buddhism may or may not know that Lord Buddha was born in the country of Nepal. But Nepal is really fascinating that even though it's a small country, roughly the size of Virginia, we have a population of about 30 million people. It's a very ethnically diverse country with many different languages and many different types of people. So it's a very ethnically diverse and rich culture. It's a historically rich culture. We also have tremendous diversity in wildlife. So people may think of the mountains and they think it's a cold place, but many parts of Nepal like where we came from, we never saw snow until we came to the U.S. So Nepal is strange in that it has a lot of different varieties of climate, variety of people and wildlife, and it's a very peaceful country. We are one of the poorest countries in the world, but you know, we are rich in spirit, and we're rich in many of the things that make a country and a community really strong.
And you mentioned the rich history of Nepal. I understand that many historic structures and buildings were lost. What can you tell us about the buildings that were damaged or completely devastated, and what the toppling of those symbols, how that impacts people living there based on what they mean to the culture?
Right. Since I came here as a young boy, I may not be able to speak to that as well as others, but I was just speaking with my mother recently, and she was telling me there's a famous tower that collapsed because of this earthquake called Bharara. And she was telling me that when she was a little girl, she used to walk around Kathmandu, and whenever she could gather up enough money, I think it was essentially 25 cents in our currency, she used to pay that so she could go up to the top of that tower. So for her, there was a very deep emotional connection to that place, and seeing that toppled, and I think that resonates with a lot of people. Seeing that topple down really hits home hard, as well as the many temples that came down. So there's a religious, there's a cultural, there's a historic, and there's just an emotional devastation along with obviously the economic and the human toll.
You are the co-founder, as I mentioned earlier, of an organization called the Rukmini Foundation. Would you tell us about the mission of the foundation?
Sure. Our mission, and we've been around since 2011, we're a Pittsburgh-based organization, but we do most of our work in Nepal, is to provide empowerment through education. So we work with young girls from different villages around a particular part in Nepal. We provide them scholarship, mentoring, and health and wellness programs. Nepal, because it's one of the poorest countries in the world, has a bad track record of providing educational opportunities for girls. And in many cases, girls are seen as an economic cost to the family, which ends up with them not going to school and getting married early, which leads to a very vicious cycle of poverty for them. So we're basically trying to arrest that by keeping these girls in school.
And how do you think that the earthquake will impact the Rukmini Foundation's mission?
I think in the immediate term, we're just thinking about the country as a whole. And, you know, as an organization, we're trying to think of what can we do. The area where we work may not have been as badly damaged as other parts of the country. So in one way, we're fortunate. So we're trying to mobilize our team to see what they can do to help. But in the long term, I do see I worry that we may regress to the point where other things become a higher priority to educating girls, and we don't want that to be the case. We know this earthquake has caused a lot of damage, but the work we're doing, I think, is too important, and I think giving girls the same equal opportunity needs to be a top priority as part of our rebuilding efforts.
You mentioned Nepal's culture. Didn't the country just celebrate New Year?
It did. New Year's in Nepal was on April 14th this year, and we as a Pittsburgh community actually came together to celebrate the following Saturday. So it was a very joyous occasion for us to get together and celebrate and look forward to. It's odd for people to think that we're celebrating New Year's in mid-April, but again, that's part of our culture, and it was just great to meet different people that I had never met before, and I've lived in Pittsburgh since 1989. So, we go from that, and then in Nepal, we had the scholarship ceremony for a new class that we just brought into our program. So a lot of big celebratory moments and events for us, and then followed up with this terrible tragedy. So it's a roller coaster of emotions.
You're holding an event today It's happening as we speak in Market Square. What can you tell us about this event and how it's helping to raise awareness and support of the people in Nepal?
Well, the vigil that we're holding in Market Square is just a way for one, the Nepali and the Bhutanese community to come together in solidarity, but also to invite our Pittsburgh community. And like I said, I've been in this country and in Pittsburgh since 1989, so I'm just as much a Pittsburgher as I am a Nepali. And, you know, we need help from all of our neighbors and far and wide, and we hope that we can get a strong Pittsburgh community to come and you know, mourn with us, but also, you know, help us with the rebuilding efforts. So it's part educational to show the scale of the damage and how much it's affecting our country and our people here as well, but also to provide some hope that, you know, there is something we can do as a global community to make a difference.
Do you plan to visit Nepal anytime soon?
I don't have my own plans to visit anytime soon. My parents actually had already purchased tickets to go, you know, before this happened for the coming month and at the end of May. And our grandfather is getting up there in age, so I think they're still going to go. I know there's mixed feelings because, one, travel in and out of the country is challenging, and because of all the aid workers coming in and out, and they're trying to, I think, limit travel into the country. But I think my parents will go, and I'll kind of just help from here as much as I can. I don't think me being there is going to do as much good as I can do from here.
Bibhuti Arial is a native of Nepal and president and co-founder of the Rukmini Foundation. Bibhuti Arial, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. Our thoughts, our prayers are with you as you and the folks back in Nepal try to get through this very difficult situation.
Thank you very much. All the thoughts and prayers and support we've been receiving is tremendous, and we need all we can get right now, and it means a lot to us and to me personally. So thank you very much for that.
You're more than welcome. Thank you. And I'm joined now by Michael Kobold. He is the founder of the Sorway Foundation here in Pittsburgh and is a man who has climbed Mount Everest a number of times. He has employees over in Nepal who were caught up in the avalanche near Mount Everest and have since been found after being lost for a time. Michael Kobold joining us by phone. Thank you for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
First of all, you've climbed Mount Everest a number of times. How often have you been to Nepal?
Oh, I've been to Nepal about 35 times. I've lived there for a year, and I've climbed Mount Everest to the summit twice.
And so you know what it's like there, and I'm guessing you can probably imagine what an earthquake could do, how much snow it could shake off that mountain. What kind of a situation were your employees caught up in this past week?
Well, the avalanche hit Nepal in at just around the time when you go higher on the mountain, and it turns out that one of the employees, Tundu, was actually who's a Sherpa, Tundu Sherpa, was actually near the summit of Everest fixing rope, and so that's a very precarious spot on a good day, and especially so when the earth starts to shake as strong as it did.
So I'm guessing you checked up immediately on your employees, and what were you hearing at first?
Well, at first there was conflicting reports. We were missing three employees in the immediate aftermath. Three employees were fine and their families, but three were lost. We knew that all of the employees' homes had collapsed, so for a while we assumed that those three employees that were missing and their families were trapped beneath the rubble. But then when the search and rescue team started to dig out that rubble, they discovered that there were no families inside. So that was a good sign, but they were still missing. Well, what happens in an earthquake, people lose their homes and they don't sit around, you know, the rubble. They look for shelter elsewhere, and that is exactly what happened with one of the employees. We found him pretty soon. The other one was trekking as this happened, and so he was out of reach. We have found him also. And then just last night, very late, I got a message that the third employee, who was until that time missing on Everest, was safe and sound off the mountain as well.
It sounds like those that were killed or injured in this, that it was really a hit-and-miss situation. You could have been in a tent, for example, in a spot right next to another tent or a structure that had been flattened.
That's correct. Nobody ever expected that an avalanche could hit base camp. That has never happened before. And it was certainly a huge surprise. Base camp is situated on the Khumbu Glacier, quite far from any mountain, especially Everest. I mean, it's relatively close if you look at pictures, but if you're there, you know, there's a lot of footage. I mean, a lot of space between you and the mountain. So this must have been a ginormous avalanche that came down, and it wasn't just ice. Like last year when 16 Sherpas were killed, it was millions of tons of ice that poured down on them. This was ice and rock, or you know, part of the mountain collapsed, is what I understand.
And for you as a climber, how much sorrow are you feeling? I'm sure you can identify with the many people who were over there who were looking forward to making this climb. There were, I think, four Americans that were killed, a number of climbers from around the world. This is something that must be particularly devastating to the climbing community.
Yes, especially because this is the second time in a year that the season was ended prematurely and nobody really got to summit or even got close to the summit. So last year, you know, they shut the mountain down after the 16 Sherpas died. This year, they shut the mountain down because the earthquake struck. And 2 years in a row for such an important, iconic piece of the tourism industry of Nepal is devastating, and it's going to throw Nepal back by at least a decade. On top of that, in Kathmandu, in the city, they've lost all of the or most of the historical structures, the palaces, the pagodas. So those UNESCO World Heritage sites are totally destroyed. Another tourism magnet gone. So this is really bad news for Nepal.
We're talking with Michael Kobold. He is the founder of the Sorway Foundation in Pittsburgh. And you were talking about the Sherpas. There is that Sherpa culture, those guides who make a living at this. And this is yet another example of how they put themselves in harm's way, and in this case, to a devastating result.
Yes. I mean, the proportion of Sherpas who are killed as opposed to Westerners is far greater, and that's not because there are more Sherpas than Westerners. It's because the Sherpas climb so many times up and down the mountain, ferrying equipment and food and tents and everything up to the various high camps from base camp. There's Camp 1, Camp 2, Camp 3, Camp 4. So there's a lot of setup work to do. And with that frequency that they're going through the icefall and up the mountain, the likelihood of them getting killed or seriously injured is increased exponentially.
And so what does this do to the Sherpa community? How devastating is this for them and for the people who make a living doing this?
Well, it is certainly devastating because the Sherpa by natural background, by design, are actually not mountaineers. They are farmers. And the only reason why they climb mountains, including Everest, but others as well, is because Westerners come in and want Sherpa assistance. And so this is going to be a very difficult time for them because they can't easily transition into something else. We are working on the ground in Nepal, obviously right now with this earthquake, on disaster relief. But our plan is in the future, in a few years, to open a watchmaking school in Kathmandu. I'm actually a watchmaker by trade, and to train Sherpas in the art of watchmaking so that they can have another skill set that is marketable that they can use around the world.
In the meantime, Michael, what efforts are you undertaking to get aid to that country, to get aid to the people of Nepal?
Well, immediately we are working on getting tents to Nepal, as well as sanitary items, because we're worried about cholera. You've got the monsoon arriving in Nepal in about another week to 10 days, and that's always like clockwork. It just comes, and suddenly it starts pouring, and the sky opens, and that's very, very bad news for people who don't have a solid roof over their heads. So that's what we're doing in the immediate future. And then we are planning on building an earthquake-proof hospital and fire hall, which will be the first in the country. And then in December, we are driving a number of fire engines through the Himalayas into Kathmandu to donate them to the fire department. That's because Kathmandu has 5 million inhabitants and only 5 fire engines, so they need more of that.
And at what point will you be traveling there?
We will leave in the first week of December. We're shipping the fire trucks from the States to Kolkata in India. And then we are driving them for 4 days into the Himalayas, into Kathmandu. And that will be the first of hopefully many expeditions to bring fire and other rescue equipment to Nepal.
Michael Kobold is founder of the Sorway Foundation in Pittsburgh. He's climbed Mount Everest a number of times and has employees in that country who were missing but have fortunately been found since the avalanche occurred. We're glad that there at least is some good news to talk about. And Michael Kobold, we appreciate your taking the time to join us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. Central Pittsburgh, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Research shows nearly 60% of candidates land their next position through networking. In spite of this trend, networking is an unsavory chore for job seekers. Everyone knows they should be networking. However, many would-be connectors are stumped by shyness, not knowing the proper etiquette, and tech savvy. Here to explain how you can make networking work for you is independent career consultant Sasha King. Sasha, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me back, Paul.
Most people know that they should network to find a job, yet have misconceptions about this particular practice. What are some common myths about networking?
The first myth a lot of people believe is networking is asking for a job. That's not something you should really do, especially initially when you're contacting someone. When you really talk to someone, you're really attempting to exchange information or to talk about your professional background with someone to see if there's some mutual benefit between parties. It's one of those things that Stephen Covey would call a win-win situation. Another mistake that people make with networking is they believe that it requires the people attend networking events. One of the things we're going to highlight today is that you can network without attending networking events. You can do many different things. So if you're someone who doesn't like to attend big events with lots of people, there are alternatives. Another mistake a lot of people think is that networking only works for people who are extremely extroverted. Maybe these people are kind of fake or phony, something that we would possibly call schmoozers. However, networking has something to offer for people and many different types of personalities. It really depends on the method that you use and the work you do beforehand.
Many people are familiar with degrees of separation because of the popular 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon game. Ironically, similar rules apply to networking. How should a job seeker use and understand their level of connection to someone when networking?
So one of the first things we talk about with people when they're networking is we start talking about first, second, and third degree connections. First degree connections are people that are known to you. So that could include people, it includes your friends, this includes family members. Also, don't rule out spiritual communities. You'd be surprised the number of people that use those resources to make connections for jobs. It's also anyone that you've worked with in terms of being a colleague at your level and people in your alumni network that you perhaps went to school with. One of the things that Orville Pearson notes with networking is that networking inside a community is easier because you have built strong personal relationships that's going to accelerate the process. So if they know you, they're going to speak highly of you and possibly endorse you to other people. So these people that you see on a regular basis are a little predisposed to possibly push you forward. The next level connections would be second degree connections. These are friends of your connections. This might also include people that may be slightly above you in rank. Your second degree connections sometimes will endorse you a little bit more, according to Orville Pearson, for your job, just because they may have a wider network than people who are closer to you. And finally, the third degree connections are people that you don't know, who may not know you at all, but most importantly, these people often have decision-making authority over who does hiring. The important thing here is to possibly use your first and second degree connections to get through to decision makers to possibly endorse you.
You only get one chance to make a positive first impression, they say. So what are the rules of engagement for contacting someone you don't know when networking?
The first thing you want to do, if this is someone who don't know in any way, shape, or form, is see if there's someone within your network that knows this person so that they can possibly give them a recommendation. If you are not able to access that, please contact them through something like LinkedIn. Mention how you know that person. And if they're an important influencer in their field, make sure you always read or watch their work first so that you can reference that as the reason why you're contacting them. You'd be surprised the number of influential people that will connect with you and even speak to you, but you do have to show that you've looked at their work. The second thing you want to do is you want to give a brief introduction of who you are, what you do, and what you have to offer them. Remember, you generally want to make networking a win-win situation. So you have something to offer them and they have something to offer you. So make sure you figure that out before you contact someone. And then mention, why do you want to connect? Let them know why. So is this a mutual exchange of information among peers? Is this intelligent questions about their work? Make sure you have that done ahead of time so that you don't look inexperienced or worth their time. Also, don't be too demanding here. One of the things I experience as a hiring professional at times is I'll have people that will send me messages and say, okay, I want you to get me a job. Now, what do you think happens to those messages? They get deleted. The reason why is you're making a rather big, presumptuous offer here of what you want from me, but you're not really offering anything in return. So be careful there. So that goes into the third rule. Never ask for a job. You want to think about asking for either general career advice, information about their work, or possibly even connections to an organization. Those are all kosher. Now, can you eventually ask someone about opportunities in their field or working for an organization? Absolutely. But you want to establish rapport. General rapport is you have at least had four or more conversations with that person. So they have an idea of how you communicate, how you behave professionally, and get an idea about your character. So some things about really big and more influential people that you really want to keep in mind is make sure you talk to someone who's at your level, a peer, a colleague, before you try to get a hold of a very influential person. You may not be ready to talk to them yet, but not only that, that person who's your peer who knows that decision maker or influential person may give you some tips on how to communicate with this person, so they're more likely to give you the information or things you need. The next thing is, after you've established a rapport, after you've gotten an endorsement from someone, then go ahead and get in touch with either a decision maker or an influential person. When you explain your qualifications, what you have to offer, and ask some intelligent questions, you'll be surprised what you get.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with independent career consultant Sasha King. Introverts are intimidated by the thought of networking, so what suggestions do you have to help them excel at this particular practice?
One thing introverts are generally comfortable with is doing research. So I usually recommend introverts do research before you attend a networking event or discussion. Make sure you have some talking points before you arrive there to alleviate some of your nervousness. Because what happens is, if you're not comfortable with having lots of social interactions with people you barely know, if you don't come in prepared with talking points, you might end up doing something like rambling. You may get too cloistered inside yourself that you can't say anything. I mean, we're trying to spare you a little embarrassment here. The other thing I want you to do is review your strengths. What do you have to offer? Narrow this down with examples ahead of time. One of the things we always tell people to do is create an elevator speech. So one of the things you can do with that is highlight your top three strengths, mention two of your professional accomplishments you're proud of that relate to those strengths, and explain what you can possibly do for a client or an employer. Now, this is another thing that's really helpful to people when they're networking at larger events if you're an introvert, is we forget that you don't have to speak to everyone. Successful networking is really about finding the people that are appropriately useful to you and you are useful to them. So if you're going to a job fair as an introvert, go ahead and research what companies are going to be at that job fair. Find the five or six people you want to talk to. Have some information or resumes prepared. Talk to those people and go home. You don't have to smooze with everyone. You'll be okay. And another thing is a technique that's useful, if you can get one, that does a little bit challenging, is also doing an informational interview.
Now, you've talked about introverts and some of the pitfalls that they may run into. What about extroverts? Are there things they need to be cognizant of as well?
Yes. The first thing that extroverts should really think about when they go to a networking event is don't spend all your time being a social butterfly. Learn from introverts and be a little more targeted as to whom you approach during a networking event. The purpose is not to get 10 million and one business cards when you're going to a networking event. The real purpose is to build meaningful connections that advance your career and the career of the person you're connecting with. Another pitfall that extroverts need to be aware of is not being too talkative. One of the things that kind of happens to some extroverts when they're in social situations, especially if there's some nervousness involved, that they will end up talking so much that people will lose interest in what they're saying. That's why I always recommend that people come in with their elevator speeches so that they're really being a little more succinct as to what they're communicating and the highlights of what they need to communicate to someone on the other end.
And you feel informational interviewing is an underutilized networking tactic. How can prospective candidates interview companies to learn about opportunities? In other words, the candidate is interviewing the company to find out more.
Yes. First and foremost, I'm going to define what an informational interview is, because one thing that shocks me as an employment professional is the number of people I meet that don't know what an informational interview is. So an informational interview is an interview where a potential job seeker can meet with someone for a couple different reasons. One, to seek advice on their career, possibly learn more about trends of their industry, or actually interview with a company to learn about their corporate culture and rules of the workplace. Now, a hiring professional, like a recruiter, sometimes does informational interviews to learn about a job seeker's and judges their professional potential to fit in the corporate culture of a particular company. There are a couple different types of informational interviews, and there's really one for three different kinds of people. The first one would be a company culture interview. This is where you would ask questions about the company's outlook, their work styles, what they're looking for an ideal candidate. So this is something that's not a bad idea to try to schedule if you can with a recruiter or someone who is at your level within a company. Now, another type of informational interview is something we know as a traditional business meeting. This is when you can talk to a colleague in your field, or you can talk to someone who's possibly a little bit higher decision maker, if they'll give you the time, and you can ask them about trends in your industry. I like to do this for people who may have gone to school for something and they want to find out, okay, I've had this education from college, but I need to understand what are the trends so I can translate that to sell myself to someone else. It's a good tactic. Another place where informational interviews are really key is people are trying to change careers. This allows you to gather information about the new profession and possibly what types of education you can use. Where I love the career trends is also for people who want to climb the ladder for a particular corporation. You can find out from your peers or people above you what are some skills or certifications you may need, what are some things you may need to get in your professional profile to make it to the top, what are some things you may need to change about your performance to do better? The general rules I give people for informational interviews is make sure you follow the rules of engagement we talked earlier. Remember, no one is obligated to give you their time. So make sure you don't waste it if someone is kind enough to speak to you. The second thing is if you're going to have an informational interview that also happens to be a business meeting, please make sure you're paying for the food or coffee that is going to be used at this restaurant or coffee shop. Another thing you should always do is a courtesy to the person who's meeting with you. Find 8 to 10 questions before you go on the interview. One of the beautiful things about Google is you can get huge lists. My favorite list is a list of 200 questions for different kinds of informational interview. So you can come up with 8 to 10 questions on that list to ask someone, send it to them ahead of time, and then make sure when you get together you don't take more than 30 minutes of their time. The other rule of engagement here, and this is for any type of networking, if someone gives you their time or good advice, please send them a thank you note. It's really important that you extend the gratitude. I'll never forget talking to another friend of mine who's a hiring professional, where she went out of her way to try to get a candidate a job. Unfortunately, they were down to the wire between two candidates. They went with someone else. Now, that candidate went ahead and reached out to her again after losing a job for more help. Of course, what did she do? She refused to give that person more help, because if you can go to bat for someone and they don't really extend thanks and gratitude in any way, why should they go do more for you?
Technology has changed the nature of networking, allowing people to connect with others online. How can job seekers use social media and other technology for their networking benefit.
One of the beautiful things about technology and social media, it has really empowered job seekers with the ability to connect online with offline. So one of the things you can always do with your LinkedIn account is you can find peers of your field. There has traditionally been an alumni feature where you can find alumni of the schools you've attended and other figures. So if you're looking for a method or way of finding people for, say, an international interview, or if you're going to a big conference, you can go ahead and find these people on LinkedIn. Remember I said earlier, I said read their work, ask them intelligent questions. Sometimes one of the results I've had from that is that they've agreed to meet with me privately to possibly discuss my career goals. So it's really worked and paid in many dividends from that technique. Another thing is I want you to get in the habit of attending events in your field. One of the beautiful things that has changed is there used to just be LinkedIn events, which they've gotten rid of that feature. But now you have wonderful websites like Eventbrite, meetups, Facebook events, and then an industry affiliation events due to various different professional affiliations. And you can learn an awful lot in your industry and make necessary connections to move your career forward, sometimes without spending any money. Another thing I always want you to do is prepare questions and schedule a private meeting with the person at the event if you can. This is not always going to work in your favor. However, the early bird really does get the worm here. The earlier you get a hold of someone, and what I mean by early, within a week or two of the conference, and the more you're able to establish some connections back and forth, like I said, usually when you have at least four interactions with someone, they're more willing to discuss or meet with you. It really does work in your favor. Another thing I do want everyone to consider, this is also beautiful for introverts, one of the things that has changed about job fairs is they're no longer just held in person at locations. You now have virtual job fair events. So just through the connection to your computer and your laptop, you can participate in chat rooms or hangouts and meet with hiring professionals about jobs in different industries. So they have them for all kinds of things. This is another thing that Eventbrite's really good about advertising, so it's a good thing to do. The last technique that I love that's really becoming popular for people in certain industries where you possibly need a little bit more gimmick is making sure you have a good professional business card. Now, we've always known that you should have one, but one thing that they're doing to business cards is that people are adding QR codes. Now, what is the benefit of adding a QR code to a business card? If you are someone who works in media, if you're someone who works in advertising, you can attach web clips to the QR code. And someone can scan their cell phone on it and see the clips that you have. So some clients have some positive interactions and possible meetings with people and offer job offers because they separated themselves from the pack that way.
And what does QR stand for?
QR is a type of symbol or code that you can use to scan with a cell phone to possibly get something. So sometimes QR codes are used for coupons. Sometimes QR codes are used for clips. So it's on something like YouTube. So that's one of the ways in which people are using it to stand out.
Independent career consultant Sasha King joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. As always, Sasha, great thanks.
Thank you, Paul.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Since 2013, Belt Magazine has been publishing investigative stories as well as nonfiction essays that impact life in the Rust Belt, a region that is seldom given the opportunity for long-form expression. Belt Publishing also produces a line of anthologies that focus in particular on Rust Belt cities. Cleveland has one, as well as Youngstown and Detroit, and now Pittsburgh. Belt's Pittsburgh Anthology is slated for publication this September, but is available for pre-order on Belt's website, along with the titles of the pieces included in the volume. Ann Trubeck is founder and publisher of Belt Magazine, and she joins us now by phone from Cleveland. Ann Trubeck, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. And Trubeck, what are you doing differently than the daily newspapers or other news outlets in major Rust Belt cities?
That's a great question. We are not focused so much on breaking news or, you know, tidbits of the day. We're looking more at larger trends, more in-depth pieces, pieces that are about the history of the region, the culture of the region that might not, you know, fit in a daily newspaper. And we're really focused on sophisticated quality writing that's very well edited and fact-checked and made good. So we're focused on quality over quantity. We publish one story a day on Belt Magazine, and we want to make sure that one piece is great.
Why the Rust Belt? Why put all this effort into focusing on these cities that have earned this nickname, Rust Belt, because of the aging industry and infrastructure?
Sure. Well, there is no regional publication out there covering the Rust Belt. So I really just saw a gap, and I saw a real hunger for people in this area to read about what's going on, as well as the many people who have left the area. I mean, everyone talks about the Rust Belt has been depopulated. Well, those people went elsewhere, and they're very invested in home and want to read about it. And at the same time, this is a really, really interesting time for the region. There's so many interesting things happening, and the national media often covers it, but they tend to cover it in a more superficial way. So I really saw an opportunity for us to serve the public, to talk about what's happening in the region by writers who know the region well and do it in a good way, a serious way.
And what stories have you told that aren't being told, or what stories are you planning to tell that haven't been told in the Rust Belt region?
Sure. Well, we have a Pittsburgh channel on our site, and we've run some great Pittsburgh stories recently. We ran a long piece about W. Eugene Smith, who's an amazing photographer who did an enormous amount of photography in Pittsburgh, really captured the city in a way unlike anyone else. And it's just a really lovely essay about his work and his relationship to Pittsburgh. We published a long story about Conflict Kitchen, which is, you know, a restaurant in Pittsburgh that itself there has been some conflict about. And so we looked at the politics and the, you know, different sides of that restaurant. And we just ran last week a piece about a gun buyback program in Braddock that's being very successful, that's run by a local union there. So these are really, you know, sort of magazine type stories that aren't necessarily getting covered elsewhere, but are of incredible interest to a lot of readers, whether they're in Pittsburgh or elsewhere.
And is that how you decide which stories readers need to have access to or be exposed to, or are the ones that you've determined for whatever reason are being undercovered?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. I mean, there are great venues for, you know, Pittsburgh coverage or Detroit coverage or Cleveland coverage that do a great job. And so if we see a story that's like, well, you know, the local paper or you guys on the radio can cover this fine, we don't need to do it. But then there are stories that we can do that other people can't, and that's something we want to be able to offer to people.
You've described Belt's style as long form. Why does this format appeal to readers? What does having a longer story, you mentioned focusing on doing a story, one story per day, what does that do for your content, and how are you sure that people are engaging with this?
Yeah, well, that really is a response, I think, to trends in online publishing that have gone to a lot of short posts a day. And that's fine, but there's also a hunger and a need amongst readers to have in-depth stories as well. And the web, obviously, it's just as easy to run 4,000 words as it is to run 40 words in a photograph and make, you know, a listicle. And so we just said, well, we can offer this kind of content to readers, and they are our most read stories. Our longest stories are our most read ones. Because they offer something that you can't find elsewhere, and readers do like to really get into a topic from multiple angles. We run shorter pieces as well. Not everything we run is very long, but we do specialize in, and long form is just a term that means long.
Right, but
longer
but,
than the average newspaper website article.
That would seem to be, you know, going against the grain, because we keep hearing that everybody's attention span is shorter and everybody has less time. So it's interesting, and I don't doubt that there are people that really are hungry for this, but that there are enough to sustain what you're doing, enough people interested or who have the time to engage in these, in reading these long stories that you're producing.
You know, so far so good. I've been surprised and very gratified when I look at, you know, when I do look at our analytics to see that it is those longer in-depth stories that rise to the top. And you know, perhaps we're an alternative, and there are enough people out there seeking that alternative to make it work for us.
We're talking with Ann Trubeck on Essential Pittsburgh. She is founder and publisher of Belt Magazine, and they are focusing on Pittsburgh, a Pittsburgh anthology slated for publication this September. One of your slogans, Ann, is written by and for Rust Belt communities. How are the citizens of the Rust Belt involved in the magazine's content?
Right. Well, that's a great question. Most of our stories are written by freelance writers who live in the region and have a story that they think, you know, they'd like us to do. And we think, you know, it works for us. And then we have the publishing model, which is what you're referring to with the Pittsburgh Anthology. We also, in addition to Belt Magazine, publish city-based anthologies of writing. And those tend to be much deeper from the community and to draw in people who aren't necessarily freelance writers or even think of themselves as writers at all, but they have a story to tell about their community, and we'll help them tell them. And so we've done three city anthologies so far, Cleveland, Detroit, and Cincinnati. We have a Youngstown anthology coming out next month, and then in September we'll have the Pittsburgh anthology, which is just a fantastic collection of essays, photography, and poems by a wide array of Pittsburgh residents or former residents who responded to our call for submission. And we have Eric Boyd, who lives in Pittsburgh, is the editor, and he collected them and talked with people. And so those books are really aimed to be by Pittsburgh for Pittsburgh. They're really very community, locally based productions.
And we've got less than a minute left, but how do you ensure that the unique issues in separate Rust Belt cities are addressed and given their due diligence?
You mean beyond sort of editorial processes of, you know, fact-checking and making sure we're dotting all our I's and crossing our T's?
Well, especially if you're really digging deep into a community, and maybe you already answered this when you talked about the fact that there are you're tapping into local freelance writers. Is that how you're ensuring that, you know, you're coming out with an accurate portrayal of the complicated aspects of a Rust Belt city like ours?
That's what we aim for, absolutely. And we look to writers who know their communities very well. They're not just calling someone on the phone and asking a few questions about the latest brewery, but they really are inside the community and understand all the different constituencies involved.
Ann Trubeck is founder and publisher of Belt Magazine, and they are focusing on Pittsburgh and Belt's Pittsburgh Anthology, again, slated for publication this September. Ann Trubeck joining us by phone from Cleveland. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, Emily Saliers of the Indigo Girls joins us to talk about the Indigo Girls performance with the Pittsburgh Symphony tomorrow night. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.